The Credit Commons, A Money for the Solidarity Economy, by me, Matthew Slater, co-founder of Community Forge, and Tim Jenkin, founder of Community Exchange Systems. Introduction. 8 years after a near financial meltdown, and teetering as we appear to be on the brink of a colossal deflationary recession, there are comparatively few voices calling for the restoration of a healthier view of money. We take our cue from Thomas Greco, who was the first, to our knowledge, to coin the expression credit commons. In the following 2009 passage, he laments the inefficiency of the business barter sector and explains what it needs to progress. Quote, as they are operated today, commercial trade exchanges are self-limiting and typically impose significant burdens on their members. These include onerous fees for participation, exclusive memberships, limited scale and range of available goods and services within each exchange, the use of proprietary software, and insufficient standardization of operations, which limits the ability of members of one trade exchange to trade with members of other exchanges. Virtually all commercial trade operations are small, local, and operated as for-profit businesses. Small-scale, local control, and independent enterprise are all desirable characteristics. What the world needs now is a means of payment that is locally controlled but globally useful. That means giving members of a local trade exchange the ability to trade with members of other exchanges easily and inexpensively with little or no risk. End quote. This Credit Commons proposal is a general solution to the need he expressed not only for business barter, but for the whole complementary currency movement. And this paper explores those ideas and develops the idea hinted at above. Money and credit. For most of history, money has been understood as a social technology, a tool for organizing society based on the contributions and needs of its members. The dominant political power, always in need of money, sometimes issues it and usually regulates its value. A sovereign, in the monetary sense, is an entity who is beholden to no one, but frequently in history, and never more than now, otherwise, sovereign nations have become indebted to private banks. One of the roles of the sovereign was to mediate between creditors and debtors to ensure that debts were always payable and trade could continue. But as nation-states sink deeper into debt and corporate power grows, unpayable debts have become great burdens on the global economy. One sign of the times is Greece. Deprived of the sovereign ability to devalue its currency, it has become a victim of its creditors who refuse to reduce the debt to make it payable. The institutions charged with mediating are all siding with the creditors. Accompanying this shift in power, an unusual view of money has come to prevail in recent centuries. Money is now regarded not as a tool for the more efficient functioning of society, but as an absolute commodity whose value is not determined by governments, but by free markets like any other commodity. It is thus a tool in the service of the wealthiest players. Quote, the key feature of capitalist money is to be a commodity whose price, that is, interest, is determined on the money and financial markets. Therefore, what distinguishes capitalism is, first of all, the fact of regarding money as merchandise. End quote. This is a strange form of merchandise which is created by the stroke of a legal pen, and when it meets its counterpart on a balance sheet, it vanishes. Money as we know it. Most money does not consist of notes and coins, but of ledger entries in banks. The fundamental difference between them is that we do not own our bank deposits. Indeed, nothing is deposited. Money in the bank is really only the bank's acknowledgement of its debt to you. Since the late Middle Ages, banking networks have wielded power over nation-states through their ability to promise and settle much larger volumes of money than states could, albeit virtual money, which only existed on balance sheets. That's all bank money is. That means the vast majority of modern payments involve no money changing hands at all, only banks adjusting their ledgers in tandem. By the 14th century, that ledger money was used for all international trade in Europe, because unlike the metals in use by the sovereigns, ledger money is highly mobile and can be created in any quantity that the trust exists to repay it. If we want our money to have the universality and purchasing power that goes with the government and the military authority, then there's no alternative to our collectively becoming debtors to that least trusted of all industries, the banks. Different kinds of money. Another paradox of our money system is that government debt used to finance business and to house people is the same medium of exchange we use to support our daily needs. This paradox might not be obvious, so consider this. Compare the momentary debt between, say, eating a meal in a restaurant and paying the bill, to the debt of a country borrowing gold to pay for an army and weapons. Imagine a continuum going from that low-risk, short-duration, small-quantity debt in the restaurant to high-risk, long-duration, large-quantity debt in the war. Although different instruments would be appropriate for these debts, all modern money is optimized for the latter end of the spectrum. This has the side effect that unless lending is happening faster than repayment plus interest, the economy is in recession. Because the amount of money in the economy available to facilitate exchange is decreasing. For most of history, however, this has not been the case because the functions of money have been more separate. On the small items end of that spectrum, local exchange systems, such as business barter networks, give their members a way to keep account without money, as they all buy and sell to each other. This is a great way to work around the deflationary shortages of legal tender, the bank's assessments of small enterprises as too risky or unprofitable, and the need to pay interest on our exchange media. And we would add ethical concerns about doing business with criminal elites. There are many thousands of formally constituted such systems in the world, but mostly they're not having an economic impact. Tom Greco, quoted above, cited some reasons for commercial barter systems failing to thrive, and we suggest some other reasons. For example, credit, which is only honoured in small groups, is very hard to spend in a globalised economy. Existing collaborative credit groups are not growing because the skills of cooperation and the feelings of solidarity are very thinly spread, and in many cases the groups don't see their own potential as part of a wider network. And issuers of legal tender, with lawmakers on their side, naturally seek to marginalise alternatives, which could reduce profits or reduce monopoly power. And this was obvious in the finance sector's initial backlash against Bitcoin. Collaborative credit and money as a commons. The commons is an ancient idea that certain things should not be owned, but they should be available for anyone to use, such as the air, or the oceans, or the field on which the villagers graze their cows. Some people believe commons ideas are incompatible with human nature, or not scalable in a global economy. But some scholarship is reviving, researching, and experimenting with new forms of the commons concept. While ideas about commons money are occasionally aired, we have never seen a coherent description of what that could mean. If banking profits were shared with taxpayers the same way that banking losses are forced on taxpayers, maybe the national money system would amount to a commons money system. We propose that if banks can honour each other's promises, so can any mutually trusting entities. This is the operating principle behind the business barter systems and the Swiss Vierbank and Letts and the Sucre clearing system in Latin America and the European Payments Union in the decades after World War II. The mechanism behind all of these systems is very simple. They just keep a record of what is given and received, and hence what is owed and what can be claimed by each member of the community. The sum of all these records is, by definition, zero. New entrants to the system start with zero, and departing members must clear their credits or debts before closing their accounts at zero. The purpose of a properly governed system is simply to ensure that all members give as much as they receive and receive as much as they give. Allowing for some local customization, tweaks and variations, we propose that all such systems could be called collaborative credit networks. We desire that collaborative credit should feature much more prominently in economics, but also in discourse around the sharing economy, the commons, the peer-to-peer, transition, degrowth and relocalization. We think that a money system could be considered a commons when the people who participate in its governance and risk management are the same people who give value to the money, which is to say, those who create the valuable things that money can buy, and those who bear the risk of accounts defaulting. Benefits and limitations of collaborative credit. Participants in collaborative credit systems have a competitive advantage compared to those only in a wider economy. They have the power within their circles to buy now and pay later. And that spending creates a counter-pressure which beckons other members to buy, because all accounts, positive and negative, must eventually return to zero. It can be issued to finance projects which the group values, rather than projects typically valued by banks. Furthermore, anecdotal data suggests that solidarity and cooperation increases in communities where trust rather than suspicion drives exchanges. And because credit can be made available as needed, it is not scarce. It does not yield interest and cannot be manipulated by the wealthiest players in the market. However, credit issued between trusted parties can only be circulated between those trusted parties, so it cannot replace money as a universal medium of exchange. It becomes more useful as the size of the group grows. However, as more people join, the average level of trust between the members naturally falls, and the extent of credit that can be issued to each falls with it. And this all means that small circles encounter great difficulty achieving scale. As with any system of trust, good governance is critical. The main governance challenge in collaborative credit is deciding which accounts can go negative and by how much, although often positive caps are used as well to prevent credit being hoarded and taken out of circulation. Intertrading mechanism. One way around these limitations is to retain the localized small groups of trust and enable not only the members but the groups to issue credit to one another collaboratively. An analogy is microcredit lending, in which the loans are provided to individuals, but only if several other people guarantee the loan against default. The best way to think about intertrading is as an exchange system of exchange systems. which allows exchange between the members of the different systems. The meta-system has the same mechanics and governance criteria as the groups themselves. And there's the additional question of conversion rates. Members can pay members in any other system within their normal account balance limits, but limits must be maintained between the groups, in the same way that citizens can send money abroad, but the government must guard the balance of trade. This is accomplished by nominating one account in each system as the intertrading account, and all transactions with that account must be mirrored by or coupled with an account in the meta system. Then the meta payments can flow between the systems. To make one payment between accounts in two systems, there need to be payments on three ledgers, therefore. One in each system and one in the meta system. Note that we talk about conversion rates rather than the usual expression exchange rates. This is because credit is not a commodity which is exchanged for something of economic value. Credit is merely a promise expressed in units of value. Thus, a promise from one group to another is converted just as centimetres are converted to inches. From an economic perspective, the effect is similar to exchange because credit is extended to another group and it's set aside and it affects the availability of liquidity at home. Intertrading experience within the CES network. Community Exchange Systems has been practicing intertrading since 2004, when the software was modified to link several standalone exchanges. CES is important because it is the only network we know of that's running different software platforms connecting with an API through a central hub called Clearing Central. And because we're willing to open source everything to make the system fully inclusive. CES only supports one level of nesting, and all the ideals stated above are only loosely applied. For example, balance limits exist, but they're not enforced, and there's no participative governance model. It hasn't been developed yet because it hasn't been needed. The conversion rate mechanism was designed in CES to mitigate the international inequalities which arise from pricing things in different national currencies. Each exchange chooses whether to use national currency or time as its value reference. Time needs no conversion, but those using national currency are converted through an estimated hourly dignified wage. After CES became popular in Australia, the team there wanted more autonomy and responsibility. So in 2012, they cloned the software while the CES lead developer Tim Jenkin created a transaction clearing server called Clearing Central. And that allowed the exchanges on both different servers to remain interoperable, that means to pay each other, regardless of which server they were hosted on. Shortly after that, a team in Spain also built their own CES platform, connected to the others through Clearing Central, and migrated most of the Spanish exchanges onto it. The Australian Time Banking Program was then created in partnership with CES, and that is on a fourth platform, and that is also planned to be connected soon. All of this innovation was unnoticed by an army of blockchain developers who could not conceive of money as credit, or indeed as primarily a social tool. Their emphasis was on security and technology. They were exposed to the Austrian economics of Bitcoin, and they were dizzy with cryptographic cleverness. Most of that community believes that better money means faster, more secure software, more realistic algorithms, and more compelling game mechanics. We wish we could bring their skills to collaborative credit systems. Clearing Central has become a critical application now for hundreds of local exchanges. CES invites all time banking networks, who are mostly on about three different platforms, and lets networks to connect to it. Thinking ahead, however, we envisage the Credit Commons as something much more powerful and scalable than the current Clearing Central tool, which was built merely with the Australian fork in mind. It should not be necessary that all collaborative currency projects be bound together in one clearing system with one system of governments and one conversion rate regime. Any group should be able to make their own supergroup, and supergroups should be able to connect if they want as groups within higher supergroups, all going together to make a bottom-up hierarchy of nested exchange circles. The resulting payment structure resembles the aforementioned pan-European banking system in the late Middle Ages. Quote from Felix Martin, Money, the Unauthorized Biography. Quote, a pyramid of credit could be constructed with the obligations of local tradesmen at the base, large wholesalers in the middle, and the most exclusive, well-known and tight-knit circle of international merchants at the top. The private trade credit of even the humblest local merchant, in other words, could break its parochial bounds and, endorsed by a cosmopolitan mercantile name, become good to settle payments on the other side of Europe, where its original issuer and his business were entirely unknown. Designing the Credit Commons. The Credit Commons is a proposed accounting framework and payments protocol which uses the principles of mutual credit to facilitate payments. It gives each group specific built-in parameters which are set by member votes. It allows any group of any level to form a supergroup with others. It maintains privacy by only allowing visibility within groups, and it runs on open source code. The Credit Commons has no limitations on its potential size or transaction volume, because each group should be able to run its own accounting software. To keep this paper short, we cannot lay out a full specification, nor would we do so without more expert support. However, we would like to highlight the following subjects as deserving of exploration. Mundell's Trilemma. The Impossible Trinity, also known in economics as the Trilemma, states that it's impossible for a country to have all three of the following at the same time: a stable foreign exchange rate, free capital movement, and an independent monetary policy. Neoliberal economics has completely sacrificed independent monetary policy, which is to say national sovereignty, in favour of free capital movement, which enables a net flow of capital goods towards the USA and a net flow of worthless, which is to say unredeemable dollars, out of the USA. And this is the very opposite of equitable exchange. We propose that group sovereignty and voluntary participation and balance of trade should be axiomatic to the conversion rate system of the Credit Commons. Governance. Credit, being a social tool, cannot exist without some kind of mediator or process between creditor and debtor, because no contract can cover all eventualities. Monetary history indicates to us that governance is much more important to the success of a monetary system than whether the money is metallic, fiat, or credit by nature. Since risk is shared fairly evenly and the amount of liquidity affects all members in a collaborative credit, every member should have a say in the allocation of credit and credit limits. Much experimentation is being done with humans and with software on new methodologies for deliberation and collective decision-making. We foresee three governance questions that every collaborative credit group needs to agree on, and they are: 1. The minimum and maximum extents of users' trading accounts. 2. The criteria for strangers to join and see the ledger. 3. The consensus algorithm itself, which is to say, how much is a quorum, who can veto, and mechanisms like that. Each group at each level should have a governing process comprising all of its members, probably one or two representatives from each constituent group. There's also a problem of governance for the protocol itself. What features are required? How are they paid for? These questions nearly destroyed the Bitcoin community, whose members and miners had very different incentives. This paper merely notes that Credit Commons members will have more incentives in common. Privacy. The Credit Commons has a clear, simple, and absolute privacy rule. Each group at each level is a private association with the right to free assembly. Their identities and credit relationships are unavailable by default to outsiders. If the Credit Commons was implemented as a single system, which is unlikely, no one need ever see its entirety, which is what happens in Bitcoin. You can see the whole ledger. Because the only integrity that matters is the integrity of the members of the groups that you are in and the supergroups that your group is in. However, within groups, which are, after all founded on trust, openness would be expected, although not required. It would be a governance decision. If credit limits policies were enforced by the software, then the visibility of credit limits may be enough to inspire confidence. However, normally all balances, if not all transactions within a group, we suggest should be visible to members of that group in order to build relationships and trust using that information, rather than what a member might say about themselves only. A protocol, not a platform. In the beginning, the internet was just a network of computers which could talk to each other. What enabled them to talk were common, or even commons, protocols such as TCP, email, FTP, HTTP, all of which are still standard today. Similarly, the Bitcoin white paper describes a protocol which allowed anyone to build compliant client software and participate in the network. An internet protocol cannot be blocked or banned by its very nature. Despite this, most online innovation nowadays is about building platforms. It's almost impossible for a platform to be held and owned in common, because a platform is a software application that resides on a specific machine with specific owners who have specific legal responsibilities. Platforms provide a high degree of endogenous functionality, but usually a low degree of interoperability with other platforms. That is because the purpose of the capitalist investment, the money which is going to build these platforms, is to capture users and milk them for data or for money, using the web services on the platforms merely as bait. Why would a network like Facebook or Google or iTunes build for interoperability if it meant that users could escape? By contrast, a service built on a protocol like Bitcoin, email, HTTP, or the ride-sharing service Lazoos is a very different social organism. Anyone can participate and anyone can incorporate the service into any other tool or network. No institution can run it or extract revenue or be legally accountable for how it is used. This reduces the operating costs. The abuses and threats to these protocols come from the corporate control of the physical infrastructure. In the case of the internet protocols, the wires, the fiber optics, which carry the signals, are owned by global corporations. Bitcoin is a payments protocol which obviated most of the payments industry, in which each banking platform is interoperable, but at a great cost to those who would move money. The Credit Commons seeks to take the idea of Bitcoin further, but to incorporate trust and credit into the protocol and be freed from the constraints and injustices of commodity money. Conclusion. The Credit Commons, as a protocol, embodies a similar libertarian ethic to Bitcoin, but instead of being an open system without trust, it consists of private groups that can choose the degree to which they trust each other. The system need have no legal existence and no legal recourse, no legal costs and no legal tender. Anyone should be able to create an account and have private relations with other accounts. Our two complementary currency networks, Community Exchange Systems and Community Forge, are creating free open source software for communities to keep accounts and extend trust. We dream of the big picture and continue to dedicate our time to develop the Credit Commons, the idea, the community, the protocol, and the software. As providers of software to hundreds of local currency communities, we envisage the early Credit Commons serving them. For example, all the time banks in the UK could form a supergroup, and Time Banks UK form a supergroup with all the other national time banking associations, all using the same unit of account, ours, which is the defining feature of time banking. Then, if there was a similar aggregation within the Let's movement, the two could agree an exchange rate and trade between all Let's and all time banks. One could imagine the business barter networks doing likewise, and from all these relationships, a new money emerging which was sufficient, available, private, and democratic. About the authors. Tim Jenkin was an activist for the banned African National Congress, the ANC, in the 1970s. He was arrested and sentenced to 12 years in prison for his anti-apartheid activities. He escaped from the Pretoria Maximum Security Prison in 1979 and went into exile in the UK. During the 1980s, he built and ran a secret communications network for the ANC. From 2002, he has been building Community Exchange Systems, a network of several hundred community currencies. Matthew Slater, that's me, has been building free open source software for community exchange and living as a nomad since 2008. In 2009, he co-founded a Swiss non-profit, Community Forge, which hosts that software for 150 communities. In 2013, he created the trading floor game with Sybille Saint-Girand, and in 2014, he built the time banking site for New South Wales government in Australia. In 2015, he co-authored the Money and Society MOOC with Professor Jem Bendel.